Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined, of course, today, once again returning from the Thursday show by the tall and bearded Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit bummed that we're doing this at 1 o'clock and not at 1:30 because I've been really enjoying the live stream comment interaction side of things. But this is what happens when you're a think tank and also a media house.
Yeah, and you got to do it. And you just sometimes
you do it live.
Do it live. And of course, we are also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm okay. I've been vexed.
Ooh, so you now
have
the microchip within you. So I look forward to seeing you growing your third head.
Well, I keep on telling everybody that if there isn't a microchip, you can be damn sure that the authorities have probably stolen them in South Africa. So don't worry.
You have to melt them down. that would be very South African. Anyway, so of course, South Africa has been dealing with a number of great political crises. We seem to be having basically one a week now. We had whether Jacob Zuma is going to go to jail or not, and thankfully, he did go to jail. And then we had a breakdown of law and order and the question of whether the government was even capable of protecting us in the slightest, barest facade of a manner. And it turns out it probably wasn't, but thankfully a lot of people out there were able to do so. But then, of course, we now have a new crisis on our hands, which is that the government has decided, or at least the Electoral Commission has decided, that it wants to postpone the elections, as we feared that they would last week. So we are starting a petition to tackle this. Gabriel, please tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so I think that it's important to note that the Electoral Commission is the government. It's known as the IEC, but the name independent was dropped in 1996. The EC, the SAEC, the South African Electoral Commission, its board is appointed largely by the president, comes out of other state organs like the Public Protector's Office, Human Rights Council, insofar as that's a government officialdom. Anyway, that's all to say the IEC, this government organ, which is supposed to administer free and fair elections, said last week through a functionary that it had hired that it doesn't think it will be able to do so in October. And then at the end of the week, confirmed that it still doesn't think that. And so the elections are, at least election registration is indefinitely postponed. And the idea is that elections will be held in February 2022. Here's one reason that matters. The Constitution states explicitly, as of the second constitutional amendment, section 159(2), I think it is, I'm going to paraphrase, but it says, an election must be held within 90 days of a municipality's term expiring. You can check the language yourself. It's very clear. One thing is the term limits. How long can municipal officers, mayors and the like, go to their offices and collect their paychecks and in some cases maybe even do some work? That's one question. A separate question is how often do we have the right to have elections? And the Constitution says you have the right to vote within 90 days of August 3rd, 2021. So that means the latest the vote can be is October 31st, maybe November 1st. Postponing the election beyond that is clear as daylight, breaking the Constitution. Anytime you break the Constitution, whether it's about something that matters to you personally or not, anytime the government is allowed to do that, it sets up a precedent which allows it to break the Constitution in all other kinds of ways. So the first reason this matters is because this is about the rule of law. And remember, we have a government that is pursuing expropriation without compensation, is pursuing the banning of guns for self-defense, is pursuing the nationalization of healthcare, is pursuing the, I don't know, add some more bad ideas. So allowing the government to get away with breaking the law, the constitutional law itself, is a very bad idea. The second problem is the arguments made in the IEC's report don't stand up to muster. There's no cost-benefit analysis. Scientists said to the report, to the commission, you must do this in October rather than February because this thing comes and goes in waves. We're ratcheting down. We're going into a trough. October will be a low point, but February is likely to be at a peak or an increase. So if you think you can't do it now, you definitely won't be able to do it in February. That means you'll have to postpone it again, but you said you won't postpone it again. That'll make you liars. Furthermore, new variants are likely to come into play. They've come into play consistently in the past and with other coronaviruses. And insofar as you think vaccination is going to save us, pay attention to the international polls. South Africans have some of the highest rates of anti-vax or vaccine hesitancy. I calculated on Friday last week that of the 22 million eligible South Africans to register for vaccination, only 6 million had done so. So it's about 1 in 3. That means we're getting nowhere near the point where vaccines are going to save us from having spread or whatever. And on top of that, vaccines already aren't that great, right? We're dealing with alpha variant vaccines. The beta variant was already dodging around that. The Delta variant dodges around that more. And between now and February, you're going to have another variant that dodges around that more. Now, that's not to say I think it's going to be particularly dangerous to have an election in February. It's not. It's going to be manageable. It's also manageable to do it in October. The difference is if you do it in October, it'll be more manageable and you won't be breaking the Constitution. So the argument provided by the commission is no good. South Africa itself, Ghana, Egypt, 100 other countries have had elections. They couldn't produce a single peer-reviewed scientific study to show that these elections have caused increased spread. In fact, they spoke in glowing terms about South Africa, Ghana, and Egypt in particular having these elections and there being no extra spread. No reason given why we can't do that again. And I think the third reason that people should care about this is the fact that the Auditor General has found that most, I think 80%, 75% of municipalities can't pass a clean audit. Like 20% of municipalities can't even pretend to try. If you have been into rural South Africa, you know what it's like to see a pothole that has a little bit of road around it. You know what it's like to see a library that obviously cost a lot of money to build but doesn't have any books in it, a fire station that has 3 Wabenzis parked in front but doesn't actually have a fire truck, a police service that takes 20 minutes to get next door and never to get to a rural part 15 minutes away. The breakdown in local government administration is not something anyone really needs much education about, but here's what we do need education about. Here's what South Africans somehow don't do often enough. It's connect the dots. Connect the dots between the looting and the poverty background conditions of lawlessness in South Africa. Connect that dot to the policies of the ANC, race-based policies, investor-unfriendly policies, sort of quota-driven, anti-meritocratic, paternalistic, highly... in favor of a kind of labor aristocracy that's not particularly inefficient and pricing poor people out of work policies, terrible education policies. Connect those dots to the party which is driving it and connect that final dot to the ballot box, to the X. It's dot, 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 X. And yes, a lot of, Gareth van Onselen, former member of the Institute of Race Relations, writes more eloquently than anyone I know in damning terms about ordinary South Africans for continually voting the ANC back into power and says, well, so we deserve what we get. But give us a break. We've made the mistake before. Let's not make the mistake this time. People have had good reasons to vote for the ANC. Lives did improve substantially after 94 and again with economic uplift in the 2000s. Really, the last decade has been a bit of a learning experience. And we've seen now only a quarter of people voted for the ANC in the last elections. Most people stayed away. Maybe most people come back to vote in municipal elections. We've seen opposition parties do better in municipal elections. And I'm not just talking about the DA. I'm talking about a widespread of opposition parties. So I think that this 2021 election, off the back of the worst economic performance in this country's history, the most brazen demonstration of lawlessness in the new South Africa, and a real drive coming from opposition parties to say, connect these dots, might result in some interesting changes in some municipalities, not everywhere. But every time municipalities change hands and there gets better administration, the momentum grows to use democratic means to achieve noble and very practical ends. This is a circuit breaker. This is a distraction. This is a way of getting in between A and B and throwing our minds off. And I think that we allow it to happen at our peril. So if you're watching this and you're tired of me speaking, I hear you, but let's do something about it. Go to irr.org.za. The first thing you'll see is a click through. go to our campaign, sign the petition. We're litigating this in the court of public opinion, and I think we'll be litigating this in the courts where it's going to count most, and your support is going to help us to do a good job of that.
Terrence, do you have anything to add to Gabriel's fiery call to action?
No, just to endorse it. In fact, on Friday, my column was about the Firearm Control Act. And I pointed out that even those people who dislike guns, who believe that a gun-free society is an aspiration worth working towards, should oppose this precisely on the grounds that Gabriel mentioned, because it is being done with a lot of procedural sleights of hands, and I think that in itself is quite abusive of our democratic institutions and of the citizens who live under them. To allow elections to go down that rabbit hole, to use a South Africanism from of questionable provenance, it would be too ghastly to contemplate.
Not very much so. I think it was one of the American founding fathers in the Federalist paper talked about how the Constitution was a very sacred document, and that over time, especially if it wasn't changed very often, it would gain a sort of mystique and power to it that would help preserve liberty. And so whenever you start messing with the Constitution, you need to be really sure that you're doing it for a good reason. And
let's just remember something, that the whole EWC drive started off with scapegoating the Constitution for supposedly making the attainment of an economic nirvana impossible. The Fallis protests targeted the Constitution as well. We are actually a considerable distance down this road where constitutional governance might become merely one option amongst several. In fact, I think he was cabinet spokesman at the time, Mr. Money, who subsequently went on to Stranger Things. on one of his days off, he said something to the effect of, you know, we need to go back to a regime of parliamentary sovereignty. This reminds me also of what Mr. Motlanthe said when he was Secretary General of the ANC about wanting to rule unfettered by constraints. With what we've seen over the past couple of years, that seems like a very, very risky road to take.
Yeah, exactly. The stakes are high, and we need to do what we can. So please do go check out our
petition. And the fall could be from a very great height indeed.
Indeed. Let's not play around with fundamental freedoms here. All right, let us move on now to something a bit more tame, government policy, although I think there's an interesting connection between this and the previous story, which is that last night, Cyril Ramaphosa, while taking us down to level 3 lockdown, which I think is very welcome, but we've talked about that a lot in previous episodes because this has been like a yo-yo.
Yeah, let's just add, now we can drink, but we can't vote. Now we can go back to school, but we can't vote. Now we can stand in queues, as we have in our millions, to go and get social grants every month, but we can't queue to vote. We can queue to go get groceries with those social grants, but we can't vote. Sorry, carry on.
We can have gatherings of up to 50, between 50 and 100 people, but we can't vote. that's not great. But anyway, the president. So we've talked about, you know, the effects of lockdown and that, I think, ad nauseum on the show. We're not going to bore you with those arguments again. But one of the things the president said is that the government is going to bring back a measure that was in the early days of the pandemic, and that is a 350 Rand social relief grant. I think the terms of this were also going to be increased to encompass more people. But basically, the idea is that if you are being negatively impacted by the state of the economy and the lockdowns, the government will give you 350 Rand to allow you to at least buy some food. And Ramaphosa said that this is part of trying to alleviate the activities that led the situation that led to the looting of last week. He also said that the introduction of the grant was being made possible by a, quote, slight improvement in revenue collection. Terrence, What do you make of this? Good idea, bad idea? Very welcome for some people, I imagine. But what's
your thoughts? I would have to begin by saying that the president's government has been talking about how this was all a conspiracy to undermine the state. It's interesting that he's now saying, well, you know, we want to try and alleviate these conditions. So, you know, which is it, A or B? But be that as it may, I think that as an old hand at looking at South African politics, I've stopped looking for the logic in it. look, you know, I think that South Africa confronts a couple of dreadful conditions, dreadful truths. One of them is that structural unemployment and structural exclusion from the economy is a reality that is going to take, in a best case scenario, and I mean, if we could get our growth up to 7-8%, you're talking about 1-2 decades before you actually have absorbed all of those people. So I am quite sympathetic to the idea of social protection. I think that the social grant system is one thing that the country can have a certain qualified pride in, proud of the fact that we have extended this sort of support to millions and millions of people, although with some misgivings that it was necessary to do so. Now, the big question, of course, you know, is the question that has been phrased in thousands of game shows and Hollywood movies: show me the money. How do you pay for this thing? And at the end of the day, to keep this going, you know, we don't need a slight improvement in revenue. We need, to sort of turn on the fire hoses of revenue, which is only possible sustainably if we can actually get the economy to grow. I remember when the NHI first came up about a decade ago, saying, well, you know, look at South Korea's got a system like this, and it was a developing country. Yes, but South Korea had this, you know, had sort of 2-3 decades of sustained growth. Taiwan, the same thing. I mean, I lived in Taiwan. They also have a national insurance type system. But once again, also a society that has gone from penury to affluence. And you can go through a whole list of these things. Social protection is only possible if you have an economy that can support it. Otherwise, essentially, what you're doing is just borrowing on your grandkids' credit card, or you're setting up some sort of Ponzi scheme that will come down a lot more rapidly in a much shorter period of time. So, yes, I think this is there is something to congratulate here, but It will only be sustainable or worthwhile if this is actually matched by that elusive reform that we keep on hearing about as always being kind of over the horizon. Social protection by all means, but I think it's going to have to be underwritten by things like the abolition of current empowerment policy or its complete reorientation, labor market deregulation, and actually getting the education system sorted out so that you are producing kids who are coming through who are market compatible, employable, and can go on to become in time employers and entrepreneurs in their own right. I'm not seeing much of that second part though.
Yeah, that is the problem. Gabriel, I must say, considering the plan currently is to hold the election in February, the cynical parts of my brain are not failing to notice that the social grant has been extended from now until March 2022. Am I being too crusty and cynical and bitter there?
Oh man, bribing voters is as old as voting. I think that to put a different spin on Terrence's point, as a taxpayer myself, I belong to rather elite group, as it turns out. Looks like about 1.5 million South Africans more or less end up supporting about 20 million South Africans. And I'm sort of eking my way into the 1.5 million from a sort of taxpayer to like, oh, maybe you're a taxpayer who has to submit a tax return. Our country is not the first country to face this kind of equation. What ratio do you have of makers to value adders to be able to cross subsidize people who aren't actively producing goods in the economy? And there's just no country that comes close to our ratio that manages to dig itself out of the hole, short of something pretty revolutionary, short of a real 180-degree turn in law, in what the rules of the game are, not just changes in personnel, in changes in what the rules of the game are. So that's something that would have to happen to make sense of this. I think that if the rules of the game did change in the way Terence described, then this kind of social grant forever would be fine. You know, if you made none of the bad decisions we were about to make, like expropriation without compensation and NHI and screwing with civil rights, and instead you made lots of good changes, which included firing about a third of the civil service, would you be adding to the unemployment line? You might as well, you know, give those guys a 350 rand a month kind of cushion to land on. To put this more seriously, if you look at the IRR's EED document, Economic Empowerment for the Disadvantaged, you'll find that the kinds of cost-benefit gains that you could make of proper policy reform could pay for this kind of grant for a generation. And it just gets cheaper as you start absorbing people into the labor market. So the headline fact that you need to remember above all of this is that the ratio between tax and annual productivity, GDP, has never been higher than it is in South Africa today. This is the most highly taxed this country's ever been. Moreover, according to Saab itself, according to the Treasury Department itself, the bang for buck that you get out of tax money is the lowest it's ever been. So therein lies a huge part of our fiscal and monetary conundrum. And I think that if this does go forward, because we're not seeing the real reforms that we need to, and we denied the vote that we need to apply some real pressure in that direction, you just end up lining up a major inflation. And how's it to Venezuela and Zimbabwe? We are currently stealing your script. If you have a property rights issue with us living your story, please send your letters to the Institute of Race Relations for republication.
I think Zimbabwe is probably going to have a bit of an issue, considering that we do so much to keep that country alive through Zimbabweans working here and sending food back. But I think Venezuela is more than happy to have company, particularly since we're not intimately connected to them. All right, let us move on to the final story for today, and that is China's new private tutoring rules. The private tutoring in China is a very valuable industry. It's estimated to be around $120 billion worth. The Chinese government has decided to
change. So that's like a third of South African GDP.
Yeah. So it's a big deal. And the Chinese government has decided that for-profit tutoring is a bad idea. Now, it says that the reason it's doing this is that it wants to see a growth in the birth rate and that parents having to hire private tutors for their kids in order to compete in schools drives up the cost of having children and therefore means that people will have less children. The move caused a massive fall in Hong Kong and New York listed shares of Chinese private education companies, and some of the stocks went down between 30 and 40%. Anyone wanting to now do tutoring of students in China needs to, they need to register as an NGO, and no new licenses will be granted basically from now on. So that it's much stricter. There was some speculation that the rules would be made stricter, but no one, I think, called it that it was going to be this much stricter. Some parents said, there was a parent quoted in Reuters who said, in the long run, it's definitely good news for children as they don't have to immerse themselves in endless homework. But on the other hand, it might not be so good if they fail to enter a good university. This is a weird one. I'm not sure if I entirely buy the Chinese government's reasoning for why they're doing this. I think that's probably part of the reason. One of the other things they've done recently is, of course, allow you now to have three children. Of course, China famously had a one-child-only policy per family for a long time, which I think they repealed in somewhere around 2011. They allowed people to have two children, and now they've increased it to three because China is, I believe, actually one of the fastest aging countries in the world because they're just not having kids. Gabriel, what do you make of this?
Yeah, so I think this is a curious case study of like you start social engineering and then it's quite tricky to stop. And getting to the place where you ban, I mean, part of the ban is like every private tutor is banned from doing tutoring on weekends. So you can't help kids with their homework on weekends or on public holidays. That's pretty wild. Like it's just imagine if you were a tutor. I was a tutor. That's how I paid my way through parts of university. I mean, if I wasn't allowed to help kids with their homework on weekends, I don't know, anyway, why anyone would hire me. So it's very intrusive. It's very invasive. Of course, Beijing manages to pull off more invasions of personal liberties than most countries that are developing. I think that a point to note is that education has become an increasingly contentious social space because of the awareness that when people teach children in certain ways, they change society in a generation to come. So the influence of private education in competition with public schools going to the syllabus might be part of China's worry. And another factor in that is, as our colleague Terence was saying, before this, a lot of private tutors are foreigners, not just in China. It's like a fairly standard practice. When I was in Russia, what could I do to make a penny? I would teach kids English. And I assume that something like that is true in China as well. So there might be an aspect of worrying about foreigners getting involved. There might be an aspect of worrying about not having a full grasp over the future generations' thoughts and minds. If you can win the battle of ideas when people are young, then maybe you think you keep greater control for a long time to come. But when you literally say it's illegal to go and help someone with their homework on Saturday or Sunday for money, I think that you've just lit up an obvious absurdity.
Exactly. Terence, your thoughts to close off?
Well, look, as some of our viewers about in previous shows, I taught English in Taiwan for a number of years now. Taiwan is it's a democracy and whatever, so very different society. But there maybe are some things I could draw attention to. There are concerns about the type of teaching that's being offered, whether it is whether it's really worth the cost that parents pay. And I think that this was certainly an issue in Taiwan, and I imagine that as China's middle class grows, this becomes equally contentious. Though I genuinely couldn't imagine something like this happening in Taiwan. I think that Sinic culture values its education. This goes back thousands and thousands of years. The tradition of civil service exams and that sort of thing. You know, your ability to pass through an academic institution, not necessarily your course of study, and whether it's applicable, but the prestige that gives you often sort of opens up opportunities in a way that it might not in other parts of the world. My sense of this is that China is trying to put the brakes on the emergence of too meritocratic a system. Now they've been quite good about putting good technocrats into their state. Now I bow the knee to no one in my criticism of China, but you know they have as an administrative project and as you know in terms of the growth it's achieved, it is really quite remarkable. Chinese students excel all over the world in hard sciences, increasingly in social sciences, but I suspect that what they may be starting to worry about is that there is this intellectual and educated elite that's coming up that maybe has a great deal of interaction or awareness of the outside world, and it would like to try and put a stopper on that, so that while families are becoming wealthier, you know, if you cut off their ability to essentially invest in the mobility of their children, you maintain a type of let's put it perhaps unkindly, a sort of dumbed down egalitarianism. You prevent certain people from achieving what others cannot, and you are able then to also to assert the dominance of the state. And I think that is ideologically non-negotiable for the Chinese Communist Party. Now, on the question of foreign tutoring, and I know a great deal of this does happen in China. Certainly, it was all over the place in Taiwan. And as Gabriel says, you know, across the non-English speaking world, you have lots and lots of people coming in from, you know, from Western or democratic countries. You have sort of funny ideas being imparted, even if only in passing. The idea, you know, sort of 22-year-old recent graduate from California is not going to be the type of teacher that a 40-year-old person raised in the People's Republic is going to be, even though they will occupy a sort of a position of influence that maybe in some ways comparable. By blocking off those weekend hours, I can tell you that will become a lot less attractive for a lot of people who want to go and do this teaching in Asia thing. That's when kids are free, and certainly in my experience, that was where you made a lot of your money. You know, I at one time I had classes from 9 a.m. till 10 at night on Saturdays with like a sort of 20-minute break for lunch, and that was all sorted out through little private arrangements. So yeah, you know, I think that I think might also be seen as kind of a corollary of the Communist Party deciding that it's going to be removing certain books from its libraries, that it wants to edit the Bible to make sure that it's that Jesus speaks more like Mao. You don't necessarily want those graduates from Toronto or California coming in.
Right. For our listeners who are interested in that kind of thing, you should actually look out the edits to the Bible that Communist Party of China has made. It's quite horrifying. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Gabriel had to leave us there because he's going for another meeting at the moment. But thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, please SMS your name to 32823. The number of the banner behind me, and we'll call you back to sign you up as a friend. Anyway, have a wonderful day, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.